Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. You are tuned to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. This morning, we hear from the Honolulu Fire Department. We've heard this week from state law enforcement and the city's emergency medical services about the concern over illegal fireworks as New Year's Eve is just around the corner. We get an update on two little Hawaiian monk seal pups who are the first to be vaccinated against avian flu. Plus, we learn how a nonprofit is helping a community that was hard hit by the Lahaina wildfires and how that community is still working through recovery. And Hawaii to the World, it is the latest idea from the Hawaiian Council to promote the islands through our music, dance, and culture. We get to know the winner of the competition. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A week from today, we ring in the new year. Many may not be focused on that until we get past Christmas, but various state and city departments have been busy rolling out programs to try and avoid the tragedy of the illegal fireworks explosion that killed six people, including several kupuna and a three-year-old child. You know, we started the week hearing from State Law Enforcement Director Mike Lambert and Dr. Jim Ireland, the head of the city's Emergency Services Department. Today, Deputy Fire Chief Jason Samala joins us live in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. I think it's so important that we hear from our first responders out there.
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to be here and, you know, share a little about what we've been doing the last couple of weeks. Actually, for the whole year, really, to be honest, since the accident on January 1st. I think it's very important for the community here from our perspective, right, as a fire service, you know, what we encounter and what we're trying to prevent moving forward.
Well, you know, when we chatted with Dr. Ireland, I know, you know, I recall the stories about how you folks had to set up a triage area on Salt Lake Boulevard just because those streets are so narrow back in there and those engines and the ambulances couldn't all fit back there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. It's probably one of those worst case scenarios, right? You have congested streets, right? I mean, it's nighttime. You have mass destruction, basically a mass casualty incident, right? With really inaccurate information at the very beginning, right, through the 911 call, right? So you consider all those factors together and considering what the first arriving companies and the incident commander had to deal with was pretty amazing in that sense of the first responder's job, right? As far as identifying the damage and the number of casualties and then coordinating an effective response with all agencies.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that really our first responders, I don't think, had to deal with ever in a case like this.
Yeah, nothing, at least in my career, to this scale, right? I mean, we drill, we train, but it's all in theory. Right, and we see videos, we see what's happening around the world, but until it actually happens here, then that's where your innate skills and training comes into play, and you just kind of let it roll out. But this is something, no matter how often you drill, and really, even if you've experienced some sort of it in the past, nothing really prepares you for what was seen that night.
And some of those firsthand accounts, I know you folks have devised a campaign that you have been rolling out. Just to remind people about what a traumatic event that was, and we want to avoid something happening again.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the first step is, right, partnering with all the different agencies, right, primarily law enforcement, right, and then doing our own campaigns, mostly heavily in the PSA or public safety messaging through our Instagram, Facebook accounts, and then through some televised, you know, PSAs as well.
Yeah, well, we have a sample of one of those campaigns. Let's take a listen.
In 28 years of service, nothing could have prepared us for what we encountered that night.
It was full, like a war zone.
People who looked like they were in need, bleeding and burnt, walking by you.
Injured people coming out of the woodwork, coming out of the smoke.
Yeah, people got to realize that playing with fireworks,
once you light that fuse and you let it go, you can't bring it back. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where that rocket's going to go, the damage it's going to do, who it's going to hurt.
Yeah, and so many of those people that were injured, you know, were innocent bystanders. They were children, neighbors, you know, friends, and so many family members who died in that incident. But to hear it from those first on the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I wasn't at the scene, but, you know, in that short clip, right, I mean, what they're describing, I mean, you can really feel what they've seen and where they're coming from. I work with all of them before in the past, and I know them well, right? And they all have families of their own and kids. So I think what they went through was very traumatic, right? I mean, but, you know, at the time, they're doing their job, but I imagine after the fact, right, they'd have to deal with some personal mental health issues, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just, you know, the experience with the Lahaina wildfires and talking to the firemen, and this is their community, right? And mm-hmm. and then just to see how many people were affected, that stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good. Well, you know, the whole idea is to prevent another tragedy and a repeat. But I know in my neighborhood, I mentioned that this past weekend, somebody was, you know, putting off fireworks. I don't know. Are you hearing anything in your neighborhood? Because you're up on the North Shore side.
Yeah, I live in Waialua, and normally it's fairly quiet. Although the past years, I mean, there's been an uptick in you know, aerial fireworks here and there. It's not a whole lot, but recently, I don't know if it's just because of the rain or whatnot, it's been kind of quiet. I guess we'll see with the days coming forward now that the weather's kind of cleared up. I'm hoping that the messaging and all the push by law enforcement is helping and making people realize that just don't go there, right? I mean, it's unfortunate that we have to push the enforcement piece of it, right? And we're hoping that through that enforcement piece of it, or, you know, public safety messaging, that they'll take it upon themselves to be more responsible and think about you know, the families that they may be impacting if they choose to move forward and, you know, have fun in this way using aerial or illegal fireworks.
Well, you know, Department of Law Enforcement, I know, said that they have been, you know, their eyes have been on the harbors, and they have had seizures, so that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So fewer mm-hmm. fireworks. You know, I think there may be fewer stands out there. I was reading somewhere that a distributor decided they weren't going to be you know, selling, so less of the explosive stuff out there. But there are still the shows that mm-hmm. are controlled by the professionals, and so mm-hmm. people will want to have a good time. I know the message is go see those shows. Don't just put it in your backyard and set it off.
Yep, absolutely, right? There are a lot of other forms of entertainment. You still can have fun on New Year's Eve, right? And if fireworks is your thing, that's one of them. Go see one of those shows. There's a bunch of them throughout the island. Leave it to the professionals. You still can have fun, enjoy, and enter the new year safe.
And so what can you tell us, though, about, I guess, you know, the response? I mean, it has been pretty rainy, but it's breezy. You know, I know I'm worried about the wind. So how are you folks looking at the weather for the New Year's Eve?
Yeah, so we track the weather, right? I mean, you know, with our Department of Emergency Management, they track the weather, and depending, you know, if there's adverse conditions rolling in, then we'll meet and create a plan accordingly. But it's customary for us for New Year's Eve, 4th of July especially, we always add additional staffing to prepare for the worst case scenario.
Well, you know, we know that the mayor is going to have an event next week talking about public safety during this time, just to remind people of the hazards of these explosives, because that's what they are, pyrotechnics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll hear more from the Honolulu Police Department and, you know, just about what else to expect. Because, I mean, lawmakers did pass tougher laws, right? I mean, if you mm-hmm. are caught, they're going to come down hard.
Yep, that's absolutely, and we applaud them for that. That's great, and you know, I get it, right? In the past, I think there are laws in place, right? And it's difficult, I imagine, for law enforcement to enforce it, right? To be everywhere at all times, right? To actually witness it or rely on someone to report something. And so now it seems like there's definitely a lot more teeth to it, and it's more actionable. So hopefully that sends a clear message, right? You know, for the fire service side, we're more on the I would say reactionary side. If something bad were to happen, then we're going to respond to it, right? We don't have too many enforcement powers other than enforcing the fire code, right? So really acknowledge all the efforts that law enforcement has been doing throughout this year.
And, you know, we have had drought conditions. And, you know, I remember back in the day when we had all the sugar plantations and being up in Wailua when they would do the control burns, right? Mm-hmm. And if you happen to be downwind, oh, you got a lot of smoke. But, yeah, I mean, that's all changed. But there is still a lot of dry brush out there. Mm-hmm. I drove by the Lake Wilson and was just so shocked to see how low those levels were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So as far as weather, wind is probably the driving factor as far as spreading fire. And so we monitor that very closely. I know there's red flag days, mostly during the summer months, right? Which indications of both humidity, the wind speed, and you know, temperature and all that. But I think that the number one factor is the high winds. But regardless, right, come New Year's Eve, we always up staff.
Yeah, so we'll be out there monitoring. You know, the whole idea is that, yeah, all it takes is, you know, an ember and some wind, and it pushes it into some dry brush, and then it spreads, and then you've got homes that are, mm-hmm. In the way.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we just had the Lahaina wildfires, and that was just a really traumatic event for the whole state.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you think about, right, I mean, say you have, moderate winds or high winds, and then you have dry brush. Well, that's a fuel, right? All you need is an ignition source, right? So, which could be fireworks, right? I mean, you know, regardless if it's, you know, if it's aerial fireworks or even firecrackers, which is legal with a permit, right? I mean, those are ignition sources, potential ignition sources.
And two, the wind, I think, because if the fire department helicopters have to go up, that's another hazard. And we have mm-hmm. lost pilots for HFD, tragically, in accidents. So, yeah, we just want to be able to keep everybody safe, whether you're the first responders or it's your neighbor or your cousin or your auntie or your niece or nephew. I think that's probably top of mind is public safety.
Yes, absolutely. And that is our mission, right? Basically, to keep the community safe and also ourselves, because we're part of the community, right? When we're off duty, we are no different from our neighbors, right? So that's ultimately our mission. And we do that through prevention and preparedness, and then obviously a response.
And so you've got the soft rollout of your campaign with the social media. You're running television ads. I don't know anything else that we're doing to just keep the community safe.
Yeah, just a heavy push out. I mean, you know, we're educating our members, right, on the new laws in place, right? So if members of the public come up to them while they're, you know, out in the public and the grocery store shopping for meals, they can at least articulate accurately what the new laws are, right, to any public member who comes up to them. Other than that, yeah, we're always pushing for safety.
I don't know, anything else that you want to leave with our listeners just, you know, as we come up on 2026 next week?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, 2025 has been a rough year, definitely for the fire service. But just, I think maybe in general, you talk to people, 2025 has been a rough year. And so, you know, we're looking forward to a new 2026 and we want to enter it safely, right? So if you choose to have fun on New Year's Eve and use firecrackers, right, and you got your permits and all that, you know, just make sure you do it safely. Follow the manufacturer's instructions, right? Don't pop it anywhere near anything combustible. And at the end of the night, when you're ready to clean up, definitely put it in the bin, you know, water it down if you want. Make sure it's completely out. Don't bring that garbage can back in house or in a garage, because it could ignite, right, and then cause a fire within your home. So ultimately, yeah, just think about yourself and your family and those around you who may be impacted if something really were to go wrong.
Okay, and some of it's just common sense, right?
Common sense.
Okay, all right. We're appealing to people's common sense out there. But thank you so much, Chief, for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing from Deputy Fire Chief Jason Simala. He joined us live this morning with a message to stay safe this holiday season as we celebrate with family and friends. We want us all to be able to bring in the new year together, mindful of the tragedy that we lived through in 2025. Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
This year, stories from the NPR archives that touch on the meaning of Christmas, our hopes, and our fears. David Sedaris, Bailey White, Scott Simon, these and other voices of NPR past and present telling stories of the season in an hour-long Christmas special. I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales from NPR.
Beginning Thursday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Chaminade University, committed to educating tomorrow's leaders in social justice, healthcare, and organizational change for the future of Hawaii and beyond. Chaminade.edu.
So far, so good. That's the upshot of a new move to protect our native species from avian flu. Scientists at Ke Kaiʻola, the Marine Mammal Center in Kona, vaccinated the first Hawaiian monk seal pups, and they're looking at how best to roll out vaccinations for seals out in the wild. Here to talk about this is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so these two little guys, they're doing okay.
Yes, they're doing well. They were the first to receive, the first of their species, to receive a vaccination designed to offer them some protection from avian flu. And there's a particularly contagious strain of avian flu that's been going around in wild bird populations, but it affects other species as well, including possibly monk seals. We've seen it in other marine mammals. And so this trial is taking place at Ke Kaiʻola, which is a dedicated hospital for monk seals in Kona. And these monk seals have been in the care of a veterinarian team there who administered a two-dose vaccine to each of these two pups. Dr. Sophie Waresti is leading this effort at Ke Kaiʻola. And as she said, so far, it's looking promising.
They're both doing really well. The first Hawaiian monk seal pup that did get the vaccine has actually already been released. So you went through a period of monitoring over time, several weeks past that vaccine. We kept a close eye on him and didn't see any adverse effects. And he was at a stage in his rehabilitation where he was ready to go. So he's back out there being a wild seal. And the second one is still in-house, still has to gain some weight before he's ready to be released again. But so far, we haven't seen any adverse effects from the vaccine itself. No side effects.
I know it's crazy. You think these monk seals, they live in the water, but now they're, you know, worried about the threat from the skies, from birds. I mean, you know, and with cats, we've had toxoplasmosis, and we really want to be able to protect those little guys.
Yeah, and this is not the first time wildlife protectionists and veterinarian teams have taken this step of vaccinating monk seals. They vaccinated them, the wild population of which there's about 1,600, for another concerning virus or a form of distemper that could really impact the seals. But this is the first time that this type of vaccine has been given to monk seals, specifically for avian flu. And the vaccine that they're giving them was actually formulated and licensed for cattle initially. But Waresti says there is strong data to support that it is safe. And prior to this local trial in Kona, the vaccine was administered to elephant seals in California as well.
Everything we do in wildlife medicine is often what we call off-label. We have to extrapolate from things that have been designed for a different species to then use in another, which is part of the reason we have done this pilot trial in a different but related species, the elephant seal, as well as a few other pinnipeds now, or other seals and sea lions. We're looking at it more broadly to kind of look at species differences, but just wanting to stress that there's this very careful, thoughtful approach that is being used to inform these next steps. And it's not experimental in the way that some people may fear.
And I know scientists are trying to figure out, you know, how do we administer this vaccine to the monk seals out in the wild? I mean, obviously, they had these little monk seals at the center and could control them and monitor them. But yeah, it's a little bit more tricky out there.
Yeah, where Steve was saying, you know, when you're working with a wild population, you may give a patient, let's say, one of these Munsell pups, a vaccine, and you may never have that pup or that Munsell in your care again, right? So there's a lot of logistical challenges that would come with a larger vaccine rollout. But she said right now that's a little bit putting the cart before the horse. We have to determine if these vaccines are effective at offering protections against avian flu. So these two pups, they both got shots, and now scientists are trying to see if their immune systems are going to produce an antibody response to the bird flu virus. So they took a blood sample from both pups before they got the vaccine and another in the weeks after they got their second shot to see if there's a difference. And worse, he said, we should have a better idea if the vaccines are working in the first few weeks of the new year. And they're working with their partners at NOAA. That's one of the considerations on whether or not it's worth it to roll out a full vaccine campaign. That would ultimately be NOAA's decision because they're the principal agency in charge of Hawaiian Munsell conservation.
Right. So first things first, try it, trial and error in these two little pups, see how it goes, and then figure out what the next steps are.
Yeah, and they're trying to be proactive because this strain of H5N1 is really, really good at jumping out of bird populations and into other species. So no Munsells have contracted that we know of H5N1 yet, but other populations such as southern elephant seals in Argentina have been really devastated by this virus. That was a group that had limited immunity to H5N1, and they have been decimated. Thousands of seal pups have died, and they may take up to a century for their population to recover. And Waristi says the worry is that something similar could happen to Munsells here that are exposed to the virus. They're highly endangered, and if there's an outbreak, it could be catastrophic, and it may drop their population below where it can recover.
And we haven't really figured out how it's gone from the birds to the mammals, right?
Not exactly, but we do know that they share space, right? So they are both in these coastal environments, particularly in the northwestern Hawaiian islands, where the majority of the Munsell population is. You'll have huge seabird colonies, and then these seals hauled up on the beaches right next to them. And so if there is community spread in those seabird colonies, which we don't yet know that there are, we have had some cases in Hawaii, and we're waiting on confirmation of a third case on Kauai that could tell us if avian flu has spread to a native species. But we don't have a full picture yet. We do know that because of the close proximity in which these species are, Munsells and different types of birds, that community spread could put marine mammals like Munsells at real risk.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait to see if that a third duck was, in fact, killed by avian flu. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote about the ongoing trials to vaccinate our native monk seals against avian influenza. Look for Savannah stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Not every bird has a great name, but you'll hear no complaints from the melodious laughing thrush. Here's your Manu Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Melodious laughing thrush, or Chinese wamei, are one of those birds that are much more often heard than seen. They're a pretty good size for a songbird, about 9 inches long, which is the same size as a cardinal. They're mostly rusty brown with a long yellow bill and a very distinct white eye ring and white streak behind their eyes that makes them look like they're wearing glasses. Huamei are very hard to spot because of their habit of loving to hang out fairly close to the ground in dense shrubs. But they make up for this shyness around humans by belting out one of the most beautiful songs of any non-native bird in Hawaii. This song, which can be described as a long series of paired notes and melodic whistles with some mimicry of other bird songs mixed in, can be heard from over 100 meters away and is generally sung by males to attract the opposite sex. Even if you've never seen this bird, there's a good chance you've heard it. Thank you. melodious laughing thrush are native to southern China and southern Asia and were first brought here as cage birds by cane workers from China in the late 1800s. Legend has it that they first escaped into Honolulu when they were released from their cages during a great fire in 1900, though they may have been established even earlier than that. They've since been introduced and are common on the islands of Hawaii, Maui, and Kauai, and are much less common on Oahu. Huame can be found from the coastline up to over 6,000 feet elevation and eat a variety of insects and fruits, mostly from non-native plants. Because they can spread fruits from invasive plants like Myconia and Clydemia into our native forests, and despite their beautiful song, they were placed on the State of Hawaii Injurious Wildlife List in 2014. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. You'll need more than a bird brain to answer today's quiz. We recently learned about a pair of species that once roamed Maui Nui before humans arrived. These birds come from a family revered in Egyptian culture and known around the world for their graceful wings, white feathers, and long curved beaks. But these birds were short and stocky. They had lumpy legs and what looked like teeth. Strangest of all, these birds cannot fly, even though the rest of the family is known for long flights of up to 1,800 miles. In ancient Egypt, the bird represented the god Thoth, and you'll often see depictions of the deity with the head of a bird and the body of a man riding. Living members of this family are found all over the world and can be black, red, or bald, though they're probably best known as a white bird, like the mascot of the University of Miami named Sebastian. For today's quiz, can you tell us the avian family that Maui Nui's extinct flightless birds belong to? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NereidHawaii.com.
You know, we started out the week hearing from the new head of the Hawaii Community Foundation about efforts to help our community become more resilient in the face of recent disasters. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been donated toward that effort, including to the Lahaina Strong Fund. Today, we hear from one of the several nonprofits that went to work helping part of our community that was disproportionately affected by the wildfires. Many of the 102 people who died in that blaze were of Filipino descent, including news reports of 8 members from one family. An estimated 40% of Lahaina residents were from the Philippines. Some were longtime residents and some were new immigrants. We talked to Eric Aquero of the organization Kabigna Lahaina. He explains what the name translates to.
Yes, so Kai Diga Nang Lahaina, which translates to Friends of Lahaina, we are a IRS 501c3 nonprofit organization founded by Filipinos who were raised here in Lahaina, and many of us still live here in West Maui. Our organization was really, the initial task was to provide recovery, aid, and assistance, and facilitation of assistance for the Filipino and immigrant community. Over the past year that we've been in operations, we've really expanded our services to include anybody in the community here in Lahaina who needed recovery assistance. Our work is really grounded in providing culturally competent case management services. So particularly, we are a designated case management agency where we provide direct services for any clients who are needing recovery assistance, whether through housing or financial assistance or employment. Even basic needs are still in demand in Lahaina, whether it be food, clothing, home items, really anything that needs to be replaced that was lost. And then in addition, we do provide other programs. One of our other programs that's really prevalent in the community right now is providing mental health services. We have a program where we provide direct mental health services that connects victims and survivors with a mental health therapist and provides them care that way for free. And the aim there is really to make those services accessible and to break down any sort of cultural or language barriers. One of our therapists is fluent and speaks Ilocano natively, which is a large part of the Filipino community here are Ilocano speakers. And foremost, our goal here at Kai Biga Nang Lahaina is to really create pathways towards resiliency for the community, not just to recover and to bring them home, but to rebuild their lives in a way that allows them to thrive. And that's really our goal. So whether we're tackling workforce development, youth advancement, we do approach everything through cultural means and cultural methods that speak to the Filipino experience, especially in the diaspora.
You are there, boots on the ground, so you know what the needs are and how
right.
to help people directly. But explain to our listeners the high number of Filipino families that were affected by that fire.
Well, our database shows about 2,000 households, Filipino households, were affected by the fire. So whether they are homeowners or renters, we think the number is about 2,000 households, meaning that in regards to individuals, we are looking at between 5,000 and 6,000 individuals who were affected by the fires that identify as Filipino.
Well, I know when we were looking at the names of all the fire victims, the people that lost their lives, so many were Filipinos and so many worked there in the hospitality industry and mm-hmm. had been there for such a long time. And so we're a real part of that fabric of that community.
Yeah, I think in regards to a specific ethnic group that was really hit hard through the fires, Filipinos really stand out. Just because there's a long history of Filipinos here in Lahaina, whether it's dating back from the Sakata days and their family lineage. And of course, there's a lot of families here who are newer immigrants. I think in regards to the victims that perished, we recognize that one life was too much, but for it to be that number, we recognize the type of trauma and the type of pain that the fire really caused. It's not just a loss of home, but it's a loss of your sense of security.
Yeah. You just think of their whole lives were just upended with this tragedy. But talk more about the kinds of services that you've been able to help people with. Because I recall some of those early months, people needed help with the FEMA applications, those kinds
yes.
of things.
So in the work that sort of that we do now stems from really providing language access assistance. Recovery procedures can be quite daunting, I think, even for native English speakers. So for community members where English is not their first language, it created an extra level of barrier there, especially because terminologies are difficult to remember, to understand. So I think one of the things that we were really key in doing and through the donations that were received and distributed through Hawaii Community Foundations is we were really able to create that presence where language access was not an issue and that we could help translate, we could help our community members understand what the processes are, what documentation requirements were. And through that, we were able to really build a case management program that really caters to the specific needs and the unique sort of challenges that come with an immigrant community like the Filipino community.
Was there any particular story that really warmed your heart?
One of the families that we worked with, they were a large family of 13. They had lost their family home in Waikikuli and didn't have a lot of options. It was during the time where families were being placed in non-congregate shelters in the hotels or condos, and that really forced a lot of these sort of family units, these larger family units, to separate because condos could not accommodate larger than 5 people. This family was very resolute to being together, providing support within their family unit. And so they bought a piece of property out in Ukemahame, which is southern of West Maui. And the property, they had built this, they had taken some shipping containers and turned them into houses without any electricity, without any sort of like modern accommodations or conveniences. And our case managers were really able to understand what their situation was, what their specific needs were. When we first met them, all 13 of them were living in these 2 shipping containers, which they had really outfitted to meet their bare needs. But, you know, it was still a very bleak situation just because there was no electricity in the area and they were out south of West Maui. And so they had family members who were newly immigrated, you know, who had just arrived prior to the fire. So that whole sort of situation created a lot of barriers.
So they just really wanted to be together.
Yeah, and I think that was the message that we got from a lot of our community members. They were seeking to be able to hold their family units together because in a family unit where they're helping to take care, provide child care, or they're helping to provide elder care even, those things are really important. And we really advocated for them to be able to bring power onto their property by finding donors who are able to provide solar panels and a solar generator and just assisting them and helping them with their home rebuild. So even after they had bought the property in Ukemahame, they had gone through the process of rebuilding their home. And I think, like, we fully understand that we don't have the capacity to provide immediate assistance, like long-term assistance at the time, but just being present and understanding their situation and kind of understanding what their immediate needs were, we were able to bring stability to that family. And now we see them around because we live here in Lahaina and we see them in our community and we fully recognize that they're in a better place. There's more stability for their family and they're not having to do without so much.
What's the biggest need, you think? I'm glad this family is together for the holidays. Mm-hmm. What else do you see as the greatest need for the Filipino community there? Is it jobs?
I think that the Filipino community in particular, and I think this is very general for Lahaina, a lot of immigrant residents, they're renters. And so with the impending cliff coming from FEMA's withdrawal with their housing assistance program, there's a lot of uncertainty that's coming in regards to where people will live, if there are suitable units for rent, and if the rents are affordable. So I think that's really where the need is, still remains in housing and attending to the housing needs of a majority of the community that are renters. So our numbers show that about 70% of our clients and the people that we've serviced are renters. And so without any sort of financial rental assistance or rental programs or even rental units, it's a sort of like impending cliff where a lot of our community members will be affected.
And do you know of any Filipino families that moved away?
Yes, many Filipino families have. And we know this because we know that there has been decrease in enrollments in the schools here. And just through our sort of personal relationships, we know many families have elected to relocate to the continent or to other areas of Hawaii, just because there's the level of uncertainty for long-term stability here.
That was Erica Carroll, who says his organization, Kaibigna Lahaina, was awarded $1.6 million from the Hawaii Community Foundation to assist with the needs of Filipinos who were directly affected by the Maui wildfires and who are still experiencing hardships 2 years later.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
Celebrate the holidays with Truman Capote and James Thurber. We offer funny and touching stories from each of them on this special Selected Shorts. I'm Meg Wolitzer. Tune in from American Public Media.
beginning Friday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
And now it's time to land the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a pair of extinct species that once roamed Maui Nui. These birds went extinct at least 1,000 years ago, in no small part because they lost the ability to fly. Recreations of this bird, they apparently look a lot like kiwis. They have short, stocky legs and brown and beige feathers. Because these Hawaiian birds were easy targets, they might have been prey for our native hawks, the eo, and they were known to fall into lava tubes and get stuck, unable to fly out. And recent research suggests that these birds may have been nocturnal, relying on their beaks to feel around for food like Hawaiian land snails. We asked you to tell us what family of birds these flightless ones belong to, and we gave you the hint that they were revered in ancient Egypt. We were looking for the ibis family. Hunting, habitat destruction, and the introduction of invasive rats likely led to their extinction in Hawaii. And that's our quiz, and congrats to our first-time winner, Denise Webb of Honolulu, Melikaliki Maka, to you and your pod, Denise Webb. That's our quiz. If you have one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. A new televised talent competition has found its winner. The show Hawaii to the World was launched by the Hawaiian Council and featured acts from Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and Hawaii Island. Oahu composer and pianist T.J. Keanu Terrio, also known as Laritza, took home the top prize. She was the first Hawaiian to graduate from the prestigious Juilliard School in the classical piano division. Her performance in the finale of Hawaii to the World blended an ole with her classical training. Take a listen. Terrio, or Ritza, identifies as Mahu. Here's Judge Kumuhula Hina Wangkalu reacting to that performance.
In Hawaii, we celebrate and honor Mahu. And you have brought great honor to others who resonate with this word. Thank you for taking us on a magical journey. Mahalo.
Mahalo, Kumuhula.
Terrio is heading a music festival this Saturday at the Capitol Modern. She recently stopped by our studios and spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. Terrio starts with the origin of her stage name, Laritza.
I'm not sure if you know the movie Tu Wong Fu, but that's three drag queens that go cross country from New York to California, and they get stuck in Middle America. And there was one like performative drag queen that she's kind of like looking through a coloring book, and it's like one of the characters is Princess Laritza. Yeah, so it was kind of gifted to me by my drag mom. Mm. And yeah, just went from there.
Nice. So really paying homage to that.
Yeah.
What does it mean, or like what do you think of? What qualities does Laritza symbolize?
So how I got started in drag was while studying at Juilliard, I had some bad performance anxiety. A lot of my mentors were not really supportive of me going into a life of music, and it kind of scared me. And as a way to combat that, painting on a face, finding your disguise, I like to call it my armor, finding Laritza. She was my saving grace, and it kind of led into my gender expression and also my transition.
And you have been performing on big stages to large audiences since you were a child. Was it something you always knew you wanted to do?
I always wanted to perform. Yeah, it just came easy for me. And music, even performing in front of crowds, large or small, I saw it as a game. And coming into my adolescence and adulthood and kind of having like this switch of like, oh my God, I'm scared to perform for audiences. It was a bit nerve-wracking, you know, and scary. And I kind of had to reshift of what I wanted as a classical artist. And then also finding my love too for composing, for film and other things.
You recently were the inaugural winner of Hawaii to the World, that talent competition show from the Hawaiian Council.
Yeah.
Why did you even apply? Why did you even want to be on the show? How'd you hear about it?
One of my good friends, she was working as a production assistant for it, and she's like, we're looking for talent. You might want to just send us your stuff and we'll put you on the bill, you know, just to compete. And I had no intentions of winning that Oahu episode and then having to go to the finals to win. Yeah. But I just had fun, you know. I'm learning to love performing again. And, you know, I perform regularly Hawaiian music in Waikiki, Shalangalang. And I think it was from there that it also just helped me perform in front of crowds again.
There was a really emotional interaction between you and one of the judges in the final episode. So what was going through your head in that moment?
Yeah, so the piece that I performed, it was Oli, so Hawaiian chant for the Hawaiian island, and also mixed in with a track called Haina Iamai Ana Kapuana from my first album, Standing Above the Clouds. And the premise for that album, it's the film music that I did for the documentary of the same title regarding the Mauna Kea uprising and the Kukia'i, or the protectors of Mauna Kea. So just having that in mind, just leading forward in this performance with my culture, my identity, and things that Hawaiians were actively fighting for, to protect Wahipana, sacred lands, and to continue to have our sovereignty. So that was one thing that I kind of wanted to lead into the finals with, you know, and not have it be about the competition, just having it be a dialogue and conversation with music, with the judges, with the audience, with my kupuna, with my mentors, you know, just having them all on my shoulders while I do what I do.
Well, I want to get this straight. How many instruments do you play?
Piano, mostly. I could compose for other instruments. Ukulele, you know, everybody grows up playing ukulele, and violin terribly. Yeah.
And do you think of each of them as kind of distinct things, or like, what is music to you? Because you compose, you arrange, and I always think of it as a different skill set, a different part of your brain when you do that.
So as a composer, I'm very drawn to the visuals of like, okay, we're dealing with a language that is up in the air, and how do we make that tactile to have it be interpreted and also digested through the masses? Mm. How can it hit the heart? A lot of my music, it stems from my culture, both learning, growing up, playing music in the church, you know, as in the Western side, but then also bringing my culture and the Hawaiian instruments into the mix.
Maybe what would be helpful is to drill down into one song off of your most recent album. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to Napuale Ilima.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I had heard piano emulating the motion of slack key guitar.
Well, I just have to premise that most of the tracks, or actually all of the tracks, other than Uli, was improvised. So everything that you hear, it's either a one take or a two. Yeah, it's not more than three, and then also not edited. So it's everything is within the moment. Yeah.
That's so impressive.
Yeah.
How did you just improvise that?
I like to think of music as, I mean, it's therapy. It's a connection with the divine. It's ceremony sometimes. Yeah.
So going back to that song,
yeah,
that piece, what inspired you and what were the guardrails that you had on either side that you could improvise within? Yeah.
So Napuale Ilima, it's a popular mele for Oahu, and I wanted to take that theme, and I just wanted to, as like theme and variation, I wanted to go with it, yeah, and take what I've learned classically in my training in New York, all of that.
Give us a taste of what you'll be performing this weekend, and tell us a little bit more about this event, the Wayfind Music Festival at Capitol Modern.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of things from the first album, Standing Above. It's going to be a lot of things from this new album, He Kaikamihine o Kekahimoku. And then also, like, with bridging the gap of the diaspora that leave, there's going to be one performer, actually a few that are coming, and we're going to collab, and it's going to be a great time of music making and sharing. Yeah.
How do you think about your place in the diaspora?
I always like to think of myself as homegrown. I'm from Kaneohe. I live in Nu'uanu, but I had to go and venture out to discover the world and myself. And I want to bring it back to our community here, Hawaiians and locals growing up in the islands. And yeah, just share my unique way of how I see Hawaiian music.
That was a TJ Aterio, who performs under the stage name Laritza. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. Aterio will be headlining the Wayfind Music Festival at the State Art Museum this Saturday, December 27th. Look for links on our website after the show. Well, we have to go now, but we do have special programming planned for tomorrow and on Friday. What are your thoughts for the new year as we prepare to bid aloha to 2025? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of The Conversation, and Merry Christmas, everybody, from all of us.